And with that, Alan, take us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Okay, I'm going to start off with a follow-up from last week. We were talking about freeing up disk space, and in particular about using SSDs and having enough free space to let Windows do things. I was saying that I actually ran dual boot on fairly small SSDs at one point, and I'd never had a problem. And of course, that was speaking out of turn, because then I find that my desktop, which is, again, is running a dual boot Linux Windows system on a fairly big SSD, I think, 256 gig. And normally I've not had any problems with Windows, but of course, on the weekend, it came up with a cumulative update, and it failed to install because it said it didn't have enough free disk space. And one of the problems was that right now I've got a bunch of really big files on my C drive, which I'm using for a current project. I guess I could move those to a different drive, but I really didn't want to do that. And I really only needed the space temporarily so that Windows Update would finish. So I thought the fastest way to do it was to disable hibernation. And if you go onto the web, it will tell you how to delete hiberfile.sys, which is the file which Hibernate actually uses. And this file essentially stores the state of current memory when you put the computer into Hibernate mode. And if you've got a computer with lots of memory, then quite likely several gigabytes of memory, it's quite likely that hiberfile.sys file is going to be really big. And the advantage, of course, is that when you want to bring your computer back into the land of the living, all you have to do is load that file and restore memory, rather than having to do a full reboot. Now, the thing is, I don't actually use Hibernate mode on my desktop, and I don't use sleep mode either. So it's actually quite convenient for me to just disable Hibernate. And when you do that, it automatically deletes hiberfile.sys. So what you do is you run a command window as an administrator, so cmd.exe, run that as an administrator, and then use the power CFG, the power configuration program, and with a switch to turn hibernation off. By doing that, I generated just over 10 gigabytes of free space, and then Windows was quite happy to continue the Windows update. And if you want to turn it back on again, then you just use the same, essentially the same command with the on switch instead of the off switch. Interestingly enough, I looked at my maintenance log, and I disabled hiperfile.sys in January of 2012. So Windows, in its infinite wisdom, has clearly turned that back on for me. So thanks a lot for that, Redmond. That was very helpful. We'll see if it stays off for a while longer.
Tom pointed out that hibernation uses up the life of your solid-state drive if you're using one as the boot drive. Little value in speed up. I found that it does make a little bit of a difference, but certainly not very much. And so I've turned it off on mine because it not only I find using up the life of the SSD, it also makes my backups bigger because it's backing up this hiberfile.sys file, unless I specifically exclude it from the backup, which I can do as well. But yeah, I find little value in hibernation.
I forget whether you can actually change the location where that file is stored. I know you can do that with the page file, and I do that. I move the page file onto a different hard drive, an actual spinning disk, which has got tons of space.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure hiberfile.sys has to exist on the boot drive, which is wherever this typically /windows. Yeah. I'm pretty sure it has to be on that drive.
Yeah, so if you don't use it and you have an SSD, then that's probably a good idea to just disable that and solve that problem. Okay.
Before we go on, Natalie has a question. So if I'm away from the computer for a long period, just leave it versus sleep mode. Personally, I just leave the computer on. You know, I do a shutdown periodically, but I generally just leave it on. I don't know what other people, their opinions on that. I mean, hibernation does have the charm of bringing you back to exactly the state where things were with open files and all the rest of it like that. I personally don't really care about that. Browsers, I have them set so that they open with the tabs that were open previously, whether I do a shutdown or a hibernate. I don't particularly care about it actually opening up, you know, my applications that I had open. But that may be a deciding factor for people too, if they just want to have it get back to exactly the state it was in when hibernation kicked in.
Yeah, I like you, Chris. I actually find it's easier just to switch it off if I know I'm going to be away for a while, because it boots really quickly from the solid state drive anyway.
Yeah. Anyhow, if other people have other opinions or advice on that, by all means, chime in the chat or unmute yourself at some point.
Okay, so our next item is a kind of a share from Chris.
It's a rant on my part. I'm not getting it. There we go. Okay. So this is, I've done some of these rants before about vendors and the choices they make that I think are not in the best interest of the actual user base. Now I'm afflicted by typomania, which the German typographer Eric Speakerman talks of as being a non-lethal, incurable sickness. And I do think that typefaces are important, and I think that most people should pay attention to typefaces probably a little bit more than they do. And I'll show you an example through this where it can make a difference, and you might not really realize just how much of a difference. So if you have a document that is given to you by somebody else, and they happen to have chosen a font that was not installed on your computer. This can happen really easily. For example, if you don't have Microsoft Office and somebody else has installed on their computer Microsoft Office, it installs a whole bunch of extra fonts, and they may just choose one of those fonts. And when the document gets sent over to you, you're using it on your computer, you don't have that font. Or they could have just installed a third-party font. So what will happen, if it didn't do a font substitute, you would just end up with gobbledygook. It couldn't display something. So in their infinite wisdom, and I guess overall it's a good thing, they do a font substitute so that something actually shows up on screen. The problem is that typically you are not informed that a substitution has actually happened. If you're not familiar with the typeface, you're not going to notice that there was a change. Even if you are familiar with the typeface, you might not even notice it. The little font dialog box that is on the toolbar in Microsoft Word, for example, is pretty small. And if you're just reading a document, you probably don't really notice what font is actually being displayed in that font dialog box. Now, the effect of it can be pretty severe. It can be really, really minor, but it could be quite severe. Line breaks can change if you have a typeface that is a different font weight or width. Page breaks can change as, you know, lines get changed from one line to two lines and things like that. All of a sudden, your page breaks can move around. So it can make a considerable change in the way that your document looks. On top of that, next, the impression or the effect or why a particular typeface was chosen can vary drastically. Seaford is one of the new fonts from Microsoft intended to be possibly the new default for Microsoft Office applications, and it is a very good font for text font as well as headings and things like that. Barlow Thin, it's probably a little bit lightweight for text, but it's good for banner type stuff and display type usage. I would hope that nobody would actually use Kamigata or Eastgood in body text in a document. Bodoni is a nice font for both display use as well as in text. So the person may have chosen a particular typeface for a particular effect, and when a font substitute happens, it can really, really disturb the overall feel of that document. Next. So here we have a computer where we have Caveat is installed on this computer. So on the drop-down list in Microsoft Word, where you choose a font, you can see Caveat is in the list. So it is actually installed on this particular computer. Next. And here we have a document where we actually use the Caveat font. So you can see in the font dialog box, it says Caveat, and the text is users helping users, which is our motto, and the new logo for the Ottawa PC User Group uses Caveat as the typeface for the motto users helping users. Next. Now here's where that document was loaded onto a computer that didn't have the Caveat font installed. And you can see it's a pretty drastically different looking font. It may be somewhat similar in size, but the style is obviously quite drastically different. Now, if you give this document to somebody and you don't tell them what to expect on the users helping users model line, they'll just look at it and think that that was the way that the document was actually created. So again, uses of a particular typeface are done for a purpose, and by having font substitutions happen, you can actually destroy that sort of look and feel to the document. Next. So you can go on in Microsoft Word, you can do Control-Shift-F, which will bring up the font dialog box, and you can see on this one we have Caveat is showing in the top list there where it's showing what font is used. But again, it's not installed on this particular computer. And we can tell that at this point by looking at that little box underneath the sample of the typeface. And it says that this font has not been installed. And it's telling you that something else is going to be used. Now notice that they say the closest available font will be used. Now I don't know about anybody around here, but I don't think Caveat and that font is very close. I think what they are actually doing in this case is they're just switching in the default font in Microsoft Word. Next. So you can actually control this a little bit. You can go into File, Options, Advanced, Show Document Content, and then there's a button for font substitution. And there it'll actually tell you what the substitution is actually happening. And so we can see in here that Caveat is being substituted by Calibri, which is the default font in Microsoft Word. And you can actually switch what font substitution actually happens at that point in time if you want to. But how many people actually go down that rabbit hole to find, you know, what is actually going on in their particular document? I don't think many people are going that deep. Now, I've complained to Microsoft about this. I use the go next, please, Alan. I use the Feedback Hub to complain to Microsoft. I just uploaded this particular deck to them to show what's going on. So I'm saying that Microsoft, how about letting the user know when a font substitution happens rather than just letting them try and figure it out themselves? So maybe, next, show the font in the font dialog box in red. That'll grab people's attention. And so they could see that, oh, okay, there's something odd going on here. They might not, on first appearance of this, understand what is going on. But maybe they could also say what the substitute is. So here you'd see Caveat-Calibri. So I could see, and especially after I learned what's really going on, I could know that the document was created using Caveat, and we have substituted Calibri for that particular font. So anywhere in this document where Caveat is being used, Calibri is going to be used as substitute. Now, as I said, the first time, you might not really realize what's going on. So next, how about also giving a tooltip so that if you hover the mouse over it, it'll come up and say font substitution. And it'll say very clearly, you know, the document uses Calibri and it's not installed on this particular computer. And then Calibri is going to be used for display and printing. And if you really want to change what font substitution is happening, you can install it, Caveat is a free font from, you can get it from GitHub as well as Google Fonts, and tells you where you can go to change what font substitution is happening. I think all of that would go a great deal to making sure that fidelity of documents that get messed around with, it's not missed. You know, what person does about it when a font substitution happens is really up to them. And they could be, it could have been using a commercial font that they're not free to download for free. But at least they know that something has happened, and they could talk to the person who sent them the document and say, well, maybe send me a screenshot of what it really looks like, or, you know, something else that they can do. But at least they have a fighting chance with it.
And Tom's put a question in the chat. Why not use mTOR?
Caveat mTOR.
Do we know what mTOR is?
Caveat mTOR.
And he also notes that in Word you can embed fonts in documents in the options.
Yep, you can. It makes documents really large, surprisingly large. Even if you choose the option to only embed characters that were actually used in your document, it bloats the document quite a bit. But that is a workaround. One caveat on that, I guess, is that a lot of commercial fonts will not let you embed it into a document. They won't let you save the document with that font embedded in it. Some do allow. There's various tags that can be put in there. So it can be a font that is embeddable and installable, so that a person who receives that document can actually install the font on their computer, or it can just be embeddable in that they can actually print and display the document correctly. But yeah, there's things that can be done on that, but there are cases where it's not going to help you an awful lot.
What happens when you save that file as a PDF?
I'm not sure. I'll do some playing with that, and then I can report back at a future Q&A on it. I know at one point PDFs were displaying all fonts as bitmap graphics, and so therefore there would be no issue at all. Then in an attempt to make things smaller, I know that the PDF file smaller, there was a direction away from that, where they were just embedding the information that a font was given, and here's the text that was used and with that particular font. But I don't know what the current thinking and defaults are, but I'll definitely do some tests on it. It depends, I guess, probably also on what you use to create the PDF, whether it's true Adobe Acrobat, or whether it's Microsoft's print to PDF, or there's a number of them. So I'll do some tests with a couple of different PDF creators, and I'll report back on what my findings are. Good question.
Hey, thank you, Chris. Okay, so the next thing we have is actually a follow-up from a long time ago. Somebody had asked about wireless printing, and I had mentioned that I have a wireless printer that I've actually never used, and I said I would take a look. But before I did that, I actually consulted the guru. But the guru told me that he doesn't have any interest in dealing with wireless printing. And in particular, he says what little he knows, he's found very frustrating. Now, we're connecting a printer to a computer. How hard can that be? I asked myself. And I also asked Mr. Google. Mr. Google generally knows everything. And I told him I was interested in wireless printing, and I told him exactly the make and model of my wireless printer. And he gave me dozens of hits, but none of them actually had really good instructions on how to set up a C410W as a wireless printer. They all kind of lacked something in the instructions somewhere. So the other thing that the forums always tell you to do is read the fine manual. And it turns out that my printer came with a CD. And when I opened up the files on the CD, lo and behold, there was a manual. So I decided I would read the fine manual. And the first thing it told me was all what the buttons were on the control panel on the top of my printer. And the important ones are number three, which when it lights up is a blue light, which is the WPS, which is the Wi-Fi protected setup button. And the other one that's important is the little horizontal one down the bottom there, number six, which is the status light, which shows up in green. And then I scroll down the scroll down the page a little bit, and I find out that the WPS button will configure the wireless network connection easily without a computer, and it gives me a link to the wireless network setup page. So I click on the link, and it takes me off to the wireless network setup page, and I have to know something about my network type. And I'm sitting here with this router and want to connect it to my computer. So I scroll down a little bit more. And now I suddenly find out that this manual is not specific to my C410W, because it talks about using the machine's control panel, which will be like an LCD screen type thing. And my printer doesn't have a display screen. So what I need to do is connect the computer to the router using something. And here it tells me if I'm a Windows user, which is what I'm trying to do, and I can connect the router via a USB cable, or I can do it without a USB cable. Well, I'm trying to set it up wirelessly, so I think I'll click on this one right here, and I get a whole bunch of words, and the important things are right here. It says, turn on the computer, turn on the router, turn on the printer, and run the setup program from the CD. So that sounds pretty easy. You should do that right away. So turn everything on, load the setup program for the printer, tell it that you've reviewed and accept all the installation agreements, that we always accept all those things, hit next, and now we have to pick. Well, we don't want a USB cable, and we haven't got a network connection yet. So clearly, I think what I need is a wireless network connection, because it says connect the printer to the same wireless network as this computer, which is what we want to do. So I click next, and off it goes, checking for the device, and I get this pop-up message, and it basically says, I can't connect to the printer wirelessly. Go away and don't bother me. So this is the first thing, or the second thing, I guess, that maybe the computer guru was right. Maybe it's not always that straightforward. Anyway, it says here, if I click OK, that's the only option here, it'll go back to the select the wireless setup method screen. So we'll go back to that, and it gets us back to this thing right here. So now instead of using a wireless connection, which if I click on wireless connection, I'll get the fail to connect message again. I tried that twice, and it doesn't work. So I hit the using a USB cable, and now what it does is it goes out and it looks at the routers that are around my house, and it finds this one right here, which has got a huge signal, which is my router. So I select that router. I tell it connect to that one. It wants my secret password, so I give it that. And now off it goes again, and it tries to connect. And this time it takes a little while, so that's good news. And eventually it says, okay, I've made the wireless connection. Now, remember, now we have a cable connection. It says, now you can pull the cable out of the computer, pull the cable out of the printer, and we're all set to go. And then we hit next again, down here next. And now it wants to load a whole bunch of software, including the printer driver. And interestingly enough, it wants to load a program called Easy Wireless Setup. Now, you have to wonder why it didn't load Easy Wireless Setup to start with, because maybe that would have been the easy way to do things. And I don't know. But nevertheless, we load all that stuff. And then we get an option that says everything's complete and you can turn on the economical mode of your printer and you can print a test page and we can finish. And lo and behold, there's a printed page and it says you've correctly installed a C410 printer to the Inspiron laptop. So now we have a wireless connection. But I still want to know what happened to my WPS switch. I never did get an option to press any WPS buttons. And so I'm taking a leaf out of Bob Walker's book. This is going to be part one, so don't miss part two, which will be next week. And that's it for me. Is there anything in the chat, Chris?
Stu says, years ago, gave up on wireless printing. I plugged the damn thing into my wife's USB port and make her do all the printing. I have set up personally a couple of wireless printers for Linda. It's always been a pain in the butt. At home, I just plug in USB and it works. And that's what I'm really interested in. One thing I'd like to point out, I guess, is that, it looks like Samsung has actually done a reasonable job of being able to walk you through this process. Different manufacturers have different processes that they have for how to set up the wireless on their particular device. And, you know, I've found, you know, some to be a little bit more forthcoming in a means of getting it actually working than others. John Fleming says HP inkjet printer would not print PDF from Avery Label app, but would print Word doc. Turned out I needed to load Adobe Acrobat DC Reader as the Edge PDF printer was the problem, it seems. Okay, so it's just a pure printing issue. Another thing you could try is a replacement for Adobe Acrobat DC Reader. I highly recommend that people don't have that on their computer at all because it comes out with vulnerabilities multiple times a year. And because it's on something like 90% of all computers, the attackers, as soon as they find the vulnerabilities, they are out there trying to exploit it. I highly recommend that you go with a replacement PDF reader. I personally use, I can't remember the name of it now. Alan, you use one from a Canadian one from on the West
I
Coast.
I use a PDF Exchange Viewer.
Yeah.
Have you got Foxit?
Yeah, Foxit is what I've been using, and I've been perfectly happy with it. And so, John, I would highly recommend that you try a different Acrobat or PDF reader and see if you can get rid of Adobe Acrobat DC reader on your computer, if at all possible.
Somebody there is, Wed Morowski is saying he turns off wireless printing, he's never had any issues. I agree with Chris. I just plug in the USB cable between the printer and the computer, and it just works. It amazes me that with a wireless printer, you can't basically do the same thing. You have to jump through so many hoops. Anyway, we'll talk some more about that next week. So the next item on the agenda is actually Bob Walker. And Bob has a whole series coming up on iTunes. And I think, Bob, you're going to share your screen. And tonight's episode is going to be the history of iTunes and the evolution of digital music.
Okay, here I go sharing the screen. Everybody can see that, I hope.
Yep.
Okay, so I'm going to take a two-part look at Apple's iTunes. I've mentioned it before in various presentations on audio-video apps and all that. So today we're going to look at the history of iTunes and the evolution of digital music. And in the next session, I'll have a look at iTunes itself. Now, historically, music has been distributed on analog physical media like vinyl records, cassettes, 8 tracks, if those can remember back that far in history. The release of the first audio compact disc or CD actually happened in 1982, and this started the change to digital, but it was still on physical media. Now, in the late 80s and early 90s, personal computers were becoming more and more ubiquitous. More and more people had them. They were coming out, becoming more and more capable of doing all sorts of weird and wonderful things. And internet services to the general public, like CompuServe, Prodigy, and America Online, were getting off the ground. So the race was on to develop a digital audio format that wasn't dependent on physical media. The MP3 coding format, which I think we're all familiar with now, for digital audio, was developed largely by Karlheinz Brandenburg and the Fraunhofer Society in Germany. It's quite a mouthful in both cases. With support from other digital scientists in the United States and elsewhere. The initial version was released in 1991, and this was followed in 1994 by the release of the first software MP3 encoder. Now, the first, the song Tom's Diner by Suzanne Vega was the first song used by Karlheinz to develop the MP3 format. He used this song for testing purposes and listened to it again and again and again each time he refined the scheme, making sure he did not adversely affect the subtlety of Suzanne Vega's voice. And accordingly, he's dubbed Suzanne Vega as the mother of the MP3. And let me just play a little bit of the song here to remind you a bit. So that was basically the first song encoded in MP3, and I don't know if that's the same version as the one that was actually used. I think the version used was more of an unplugged version without the electronic instruments, but I wasn't able to find a copy on the internet. So once the MP3 encoder was released, the very first real-time software MP3 player, which was WinPlay 3, was released in 1995. And so many people were able to encode and then play back MP3 files on their personal computers. Because of the relatively small hard drives of the era, and I think we remember back then in a lot of cases, the lossy compression was essential. So you could store multiple albums worth of music on a home computer as full recordings. So the software-based digital music revolution had begun. CDs and cassettes had already been largely replaced, vinyl records and 8-track tapes, and now they would all be replaced by software-based digital media. MP3, it wasn't the first digital software format for audio, and it wasn't really the best, but it was the first one to gain widespread popular use because of its ability to store large amounts of audio data at a reasonable quality level. And, of course, the fact that it was free certainly didn't help hurt the adoption either. So a couple of years later, in 2001, Apple introduced the iTunes app and the iPod musical player. The iTunes app quickly became the most popular digital music player, and the iPod replaced the Sony Walkman and the Sony Discman as a premier portable music player family. And you see here where the original version of iTunes was distributed on a CD. And a picture there of the original iPod. So in the early 2000s, the music industry was facing a very serious piracy problem on several fronts, and especially from peer-to-peer file sharing services like Napster. After all, why pay $20 for a CD or a cassette, especially if you just want one or two of the songs, when you get it for free? So the music industry got all upset about this, and they basically prosecuted services like Napster out of existence, and even prosecuted individual users. But the problem still exists. Where can people get reasonably priced music conveniently online, as opposed to having to schlep down to your nearest, or maybe even not so near, music store? And you know, getting rid of Napster didn't necessarily help all that much. Other services sprung up and continue to spring up. So getting rid of serious music piracy became a never-ending game of whack-a-mole. Now, Apple's Steve Jobs, he finally convinced the five biggest music publishers to let him sell individual songs and even full albums online for a reasonable price. And in 2003, the iTunes Store was launched. So although the iTunes app wasn't the first MP3 player, and the iPod wasn't the first dedicated MP3 music player device, when you combine this with the iTunes Store, it became an unbeatable combination. The music publishers, they finally realized that with online sales, they didn't need to produce hard copies like CDs, cassettes, etc. They didn't need to warehouse them. They didn't need to ship them. They didn't need to take back and scrap unsold copies. And they didn't get caught with their pants down when an album or a single became unexpectedly popular and they didn't have enough copies to sell. All of these costs and all of these problems disappeared for them. So after Apple started with the iTunes Store, it wasn't long before other legal online music stores opened up. This caused a little bit of a competition problem with the good folks at Apple. So to compete, they started adding other media like videos, movies, TV shows, podcasts, and other things. And they started adding more and more and more and more and more features to iTunes. And many of them were not particularly wanted or particularly well received. Sort of sounds like Windows 11. In the beginning, the iTunes Store used Apple's FairPlay Digital Rights Management, or DRM. This is also known as copy protection. FairPlay had several issues with device compatibility. It wouldn't play on certain devices properly, and this especially was a problem with non-Apple devices. There were various successful bootleg efforts to remove the DRM protection from files, and Apple continuously had to update its software to counteract these efforts. So starting in 2007 with EMI Records, Apple signed deals with all the major record labels, as well as a lot of the independent labels, to offer iTunes customers at an extra cost purchase option for higher quality DRM-free version of the label's tracks. And most of these were in the M4A lossless format instead of the very lossy MP3. So you got a much better audio quality to the music. So over the next few years, though, this multi-tier pricing model was eventually removed for most of the music in the iTunes Store, because fewer and fewer people were willing to put up with the poor quality of the cheap model. That said, television episodes, a lot of the books and films on the iTunes store are still fair play protected. So by the mid-2010s, streaming media services like Spotify were starting to generate more revenue than the buy-to-own model used by the iTunes store. So Apple now operates its own subscription-based streaming music service called Apple Music alongside the iTunes store. So they're getting the best of both worlds here. A lot of people still won't like the buy-to-own model. Other people are quite happy with streaming the music. So although iTunes was very well received in its early years, it got more and more criticism for a bloated user experience, which ended up incorporating features well beyond the original focus on music. So as a result, beginning with Mac's running OS, Mac OS Catalina in 2019, iTunes has been replaced with separate apps, namely music, podcasts, and TV. And they have an app called Finder taking over the device management and overall management capabilities. So far, this hasn't affected iTunes running on Windows or on the older Mac OS versions. So for now, the iTunes store is still a great way to buy downloadable music and other downloadable digital media. And for Windows users, the iTunes app is what you need to be able to use all this. So that's it for a look at the history of iTunes and the evolution of digital music. Next session, we'll have a quick look at the basics of using the iTunes app and the iTunes store to sample and to buy music and to access your online library of digital music. And we'll also have a look at some alternatives to iTunes, both for purchasing your music and for managing your music. And that's it for today.
Okay, thanks, Bob. Tom's put a comment in the chat that iTunes songs are not sold. They're licensed. You basically have a lifetime license.
Well, that's sort of like splitting hairs. You know, if you're the person putting the money up for the tunes, you know, you basically purchase it, you download it, and yeah, like a lot of media, even if you buy a CD or other physical media, you're still not buying the song. You're buying the license. And you're not allowed to use it for profit, like playing it on a radio station or sharing it with others. So all the music that you pay money for is basically a license, not a purchase. But again, that's sort of like splitting hairs a bit.
And Tom's
comment
says you can buy and sell media and leave to your splitting heirs, as in friends and relations when you die.
But you can't do that with a licensed song. It's just that the media you can sell, and that includes the songs. But if you don't have any media that it came with, then you can't legally sell it or leave it.
Well, that goes back to vinyl records. You know, you could copy your vinyl record onto a cassette and legally play it in your car, for example, but and maybe play it at a party you were giving. But it was illegal, technically illegal, to give that cassette to a friend or to play that song on a radio station without paying licensing fees. So,
you know, but you could, for example, sell your vinyl. In fact, some people are selling vinyl for huge amounts these days. Unless you have, a non-fungible token, you couldn't do that with a song.
Not legally, but.
And Ed had made a comment. Miss Vega wrote about being informed that her tune was being used for MP3 testing, and she said she was quite flattered.
Yeah, she was also found out a few years later that a rap type group called DNA had used her basic song and had added all the drums and the electronic instruments and all that to it. And at first she was a little bit annoyed, but then when she actually listened to it and whatever, they came out jointly with a recording and shared the royalties. So she's not done that bad with all this.
And talking about songs and people dying, Tim notes that if you don't back your music up, it will die if the computer dies.
Well, that pretty much is the case for all your data on the computer. You got to back it all up, or else too bad, so sad. And I believe Alan, that you and Chris have on many occasions over the years given many presentations on backing up your data and information and the importance of doing so, and all sorts of great methods to do it.
And there's all kinds of information on the club website about doing that too. But I'm sure everybody's backing up everything routinely and assiduously, aren't you?
And I've never given a USB key to friends with songs on it.
That's your off-site backup, is it?
Yep.
Okay, well, as Chris said, we do actually have some time for once. So if anybody has any questions that we haven't covered already, or comments on anything that's transpired, or items that you'd like to share with the group, the lines are open, the chat line and the microphone lines, and however you wish to contact us. Allison says, if you buy a song on iTunes, you can log into your account on any device and download it. I believe you can authorize up to 5 devices per account.
And then you can always burn things to a CD as well.
Yeah, I believe the iTunes is sort of like the Amazon Kindle for your ebooks and several other things. Is you can actually have more devices enabled on your account, but any particular song or album or any particular book can only be downloaded to 5 devices. So if you want to download it to another device, you have to disable it on other devices. And if you're not careful when you first enable a device by naming a property, you end up with Windows Device 1, Windows Device 2, Windows Device 3. So when you get a new computer and you go to unauthorize your old one, well, which one is it? So if your family, for example, or if you have several computers that you use, or the device can also include your smartphone, and in some cases your car infotainment system, it gets quite hard to keep track of them all if you're not careful in how you set them up and giving them a unique name.
You have to use FairPlay to play them, though, don't you? So that means that you need iTunes on the particular device. For example, if iTunes doesn't, if there's no Android app, for example, you couldn't play an iTunes song on an Android phone, for example, well, or tablet.
iTunes got rid of the copy protection or the fair play protection on their music several years ago. And so, everything I've gotten from iTunes, is uncopy protected. I can copy it to any of my devices myself, USB sticks. I often make USB mixtape sticks for playing in the car.
So I just got a question on the chat window. I use my Asus T100 hybrid tablet as an e-reader, and I was using Livy, but they discontinued that for Windows-based computers. So I switched back to Overdrive, which is the older version. But now I got a message just recently that they're going to discontinue the PC version of Overdrive. So my question is, what software will read ebooks from the Ottawa Public Library?
You'd best ask the Ottawa Public Library that question.
Oh, good luck.
Yeah, they're not particularly forthcoming with any aid on their online media and whatever. I actually gave an online talk on ebooks for the library. I think it was last summer, and it was noted that they seem to have a hard time giving support to their users on their online users, so it's seems to be an ongoing problem with them.
Yeah, Tom's saying that Caliber will work, which will be good because I think that's highly recommended as an e-reader. Allison says she still uses Overdrive, but the last book she got from the library is on Cloud Library, and she's not sure if it's going to replace Overdrive or it's just another app. Now, I believe the latter. I believe Cloud Library is a different set of ebooks than Overdrive.
Does the library say anything about what will replace Overdrive?
I haven't seen anything, Chris, but I have a horror of going into the OPL website to find out anything useful.
Yeah, it's hard to find anything there.
Yeah, I subscribe to a service called BookBub. It's a free subscription. They send you an email every day with the deals of the day. The books range in cost from absolutely free up to $2.99 per book, which is quite reasonable. And they have something like 44 different categories of books. You can pick which categories you want to subscribe to and that you're interested in. And you can build up quite a library of books fairly quickly. And it ranges anywhere from, bestsellers from a few years ago, or whatever. If you want to get a current bestseller, you're stuck going to the Kobo or the Kindle websites. But a service like BookBub gives you all sorts of deals.
Yeah, the good thing about the Ottawa Public Library is that all the books there are free.
Yeah.
Tristan says Kobo readers will work for the library. Anything that supports EPUB format, so presumably that's why Caliber is going to work.
Kindle does not support EPUB. The Amazon Kindle readers or the Amazon Kindle apps do not support EPUB.
Kobo reader, not Kindle.
Yeah.
Okay, just in the interest of having put out a call for other questions, we did actually get another question from Darlene. Wasn't sure was going to attend tonight. Do have a new item. Going to buy a USB drive, I presume is what it is, an external drive, and it is a Type-C connector. Told this works on devices 2 to 3 years old. Well, any device that has a Type-C connector, it'll work on. Does this mean the older USBs I have lying around the house will become obsolete? This could be a flash drive as well, I suppose. Two things on that that I guess I would, or a couple of things I would say. First off is that you probably pay a premium on most Type-C connected devices as it stands right now. So you're future-proofing in that you will get better performance and so forth out of something connected on USB Type-C. You can get cables that will go from USB Type-C to Type-A connectors. So you could buy a USB Type-C connected device, whether it's an external hard drive or flash drive or whatever, and then if your current computer doesn't have a Type-C port on it, you could connect a dongle cable that will convert from the USB Type-C to Type-A. Depending on the usage, I'm not sure I really care. Like, I just bought today, actually, a Western Digital 5 terabyte portable drive, and it cost me $145, I think it was, or something like that. And it would have been about another $20 to get their next up model, which is the My Passport Ultra, which connects on USB Type-C. For my use case on there, I don't really care about, you know, getting the best performance out of it. It's used for offsite backups. If it takes 2 hours to do the backup on a Type A and it takes, you know, an hour and 40 minutes on Type C, you know, I really don't care. So in cases like that, USB Type A connectors are going to be around for a long time, I'm sure. So that's my personal opinion on that. I don't know if anybody else wants to weigh in with what they think is, whether it's really worth going with Type-C connectors at this point in time, you know, come hell or high water or high prices, or whether, you know, a lot of stuff, Type-A connector is perfectly adequate at this point in time.
Yeah, my feeling, Chris, is if you, it depends on what you've got as a port. If you don't have a Type-C port on your device, personally, I wouldn't buy a Type-C drive.
Well, it's a future-proofing type thing too, right? You're going to probably, you know, if you have, say, an external hard drive, it's probably going to be kicking around longer than your computer is going to be kicking around, you hope. And so your next computer probably would have a Type-C connector. So it is a future-proofing sort of thing, but the extra performance, personally, I don't think it's, you know, it's not that big a deal. If I had equal cost, I would go with the Type-C connector device and do a cable connection to convert it to a Type A is the route that I would go. But I find that most cases, flash drives as well as external hard drives, if you get one that has a Type-C connector, they are typically more expensive and by a considerable degree than Type-A connectors.
It's only future-proofing as long as they don't bring out USB-D.
Yeah.
Bob Walker here. The laptop I'm using right now, among other things, has a USB-C connector on it, and I use a little adapter cable to frequently connect USB-A or USB micro devices to the USB-C port, and vice versa. And my wife's smartphone has a USB-C connector, and I can plug in a USB-A or USB micro flash drive to back it up or to plug it directly into my computer. So the deal is with USB-C to USB-C, you'll get higher data throughput and everything, but otherwise everything is perfectly compatible.
Yeah. Yeah, and the cables, I mean, I'm, you know, looking at Amazon, you can get them for like $1.85. That'll just a cable that will go from USB Type-A to Type-C. So, you know, it's a pretty cheap solution to go if you do have a Type-C device that you want to plug into a Type-A port.
You do want to be careful. The USB-C is just the physical design, but it usually supports up to 20, sometimes even 40 gigabits. I think gigabits per second.
I think it's gigabits, yeah.
And but USB-A, if it's 3.2 Gen 2, is 10 gigabits per second. Gen 1 is 5 megabits per second, and those are definitely the sort of speeds you need, or at least you want, for a hard drive. Because if you just go with USB-A version 2.0, it's like 480 megabits per second, so that's like 0.5 gigabits per second, and that's way that's probably slower than fast hard drives these days.
Okay, well, that was a good discussion of various things. I noticed Natalie's put the information on how to contact the library, so I will give that a whirl, and I'll report back on how I do. So, to wrap up, I just want to remind you that we start our fall session of the regular monthly meetings in September. The first one will be September the 14th, and it's going to be members' favorites. So if you have anything that you'd like to present to the group, an application, piece of hardware, some operating system information, anything along the lines of a 10, 20-minute presentation, we're very flexible. Just send us a little note as to what it is that you're thinking you'd like to present, and we'll sign you up for September the 14th. But before that, next week will be our next Q&A, so Wednesday the 24th, and the slate is pretty well clean at the moment, so if you have questions or topics that you'd like to share next week, do the same thing. Send us an email, and we'll slot you in. So that's it for me. I hope everybody enjoyed the evening, and we'll see you all next week.
Thanks, folks. See you next week.